How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
Welcome to Climate One, a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. To understand any of them, you have to understand them all. I'm Greg Dalton. Our topic today is climate and science education in the San Francisco Bay Area and around the country. Many young people are well informed about the impacts of fossil fuels and the promise of an economy running on clean power. But science has become a contentious topic in some communities, and we'll talk about challenges in bringing environmental education beyond the left and right coasts. During the next hour, we'll discuss teaching our children well and include questions from our live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. We're pleased to have two students and two social entrepreneurs who have founded national organizations. Bridger Murray is a sixth grader in Marin, active with Cool the Earth campaign. Rosemary Davies is a graduate of Berkeley High School Green Academy. In the summer of 2012, she went on an Arctic expedition with Students on ICE, a Canadian educational organization. She received a Climate One scholarship to go on that trip. Mike Haas is founder of the Alliance for Climate Education and CEO of Orion Renewable Energy Group. He's also a financial contributor to Climate One. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Carlene Cullen, founder and executive director of Cool the Earth. She'll come up and join us, so please welcome them to Climate One. Bridger, let's begin with you. I want to ask each of the participants today that your sort of your story of how you became conscious about the climate. And I understand you played Mr. Carbon in a school play. That must have been fun. Were you Mr. Carbon a good guy or bad guy?
He was usually a bad guy.
Usually a bad guy. Okay. So tell us about that play and how you got involved in climate education.
So the Green Team, as it was called, came to my school, I think, when I was in third or second grade, and it came there. I didn't really, I was in second grade or third grade, I can't remember, obviously, so I didn't really know what it was about, you know, Green Team, what's this, but I decided to join it because I thought it was some club, you know, so I joined it, and,
Do you join lots of clubs?
Yeah, I'm usually, I like activities and stuff, but anyways, I thought it was some... I thought it was, you know, some club, or as I said before. So I joined it, and I was like, hey, this is actually pretty cool. It was, you know, talked about climate change, green, reducing carbon dioxide, that kind of stuff. And then it took off from there with Cool the Earth, and I started getting in skits, that kind of thing. I think I played Mother Earth a few times. I was... As I brought this cartoonish polar bear hat too, that's was one of the costumes that you wear and you know your head during the skits, and it was you could wear this. There was, I think, some of the characters were Coda the polar bear and those kind of things. So.
And the polar bear chases Mr. Carbon?
Yeah, they chase them around the stage usually. So.
And does the play have a happy ending?
Yeah, usually. It's usually, well, sometimes sometimes it's kind of almost a cliffhanger. It's like, you know, Mr. Carbon is like inside the reaches of Coda the Polar Bear and says, you can help, you know, kind of something like that. He pointed to the audience. So.
It's kind of like Hollywood. They had test market different endings,
yeah,
I guess. Okay.
Exactly.
And then you got involved in Cool the Earth and you started to take specific actions at home. Tell us about some of the actions that you did at home to save energy.
Yeah, one of the things that Cool the Earth brought to our school was like a bright yellow coupon book, and it had various quote-unquote coupons in there that were basically slips of paper that you would fill out, and they would have, I think it was the amount of CO2 that you could reduce by, they had actions on it, and the amount of CO2 you could reduce by doing the actions, and it was usually something very simple, but very, it was effective, such as, you know, bringing aluminum metal water bottles instead of plastic ones, riding your bike to school, you know, that type of thing.
Food?
Yeah, there was some stuff about, I think it was cutting back on, I think there was like a meat-free day once a week, try to do something like that.
Meatless Mondays, a lot of people
do.
Yeah,
meatless Mondays. And I think it was eat a pound less of beef a week, which reduced CO2 emissions.
And sometimes you get lazy and don't do the things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Various times. The coupon book was not something I would do because I just took it as, you know, extra homework, I suppose. But I would still do the actions. I would, you know, flip through it. I would do the actions. The coupon book wasn't something that worked for me, but it was really big hit with everybody else, and it really got kids doing it. So.
Thank you. Rosemary Davies, tell us how you went from growing up on a chestnut farm to the Green Academy at Berkeley High School.
Let's see. So I grew up on a chestnut orchard, my grandparents' farm, and that really surrounded me with nature, open space. It gave me an innate connection that I was a part of nature instead of being outside of it. And so when we moved in the city 10 years later, and it was so industrial and there were so many buildings and everything was on oil, it was a little shocking at first, but then I guess I kind of adapted to it, and I kind of still brought that that kind of farm, small town perspective. And I went from middle school to high school, and I kept trying new things, like whatever interested me. So like equilibristic juggling, I tried that. I was into yo-yoing for a while, drumming, then guitar, and then pin making, and then creative reuse projects. And then when it came time for high school, I chose the Green Academy initially because my sister was in it, and it was easier for my mom, who was a single parent. But then I got really into it, and it was helpful at Berkeley High School, where it's a zoo, and there's 3,400 students there, and it's hard to really... I guess, stay motivated and stay focused, that the Green Academy helped me by tying me back to nature and bringing me to the city where I still kind of saw my environmental impact. I still could get involved with, like, organizations like Save the Bay, local food markets. So it was great. It's, nature has always followed me.
I've been over to Berkeley High School and attended, and the students there have an very impressive knowledge of measuring their impacts and vampire loads at home and all sorts of very sophisticated things. Tell us briefly about, then you went to the Arctic last year on this two-week expedition with students from around the world, a lot of Americans and Canadians and others, and how did that impact you?
It showed me that what I did had real life consequences. Like, my family always told me, whatever you do or don't do has a consequence. And I always kind of knew that. But going to the Arctic, it really reinforced it. And it helped me see that, oh my God, my carbon footprint affects all these people in the Arctic, all the wildlife, people's futures. And it also helped me see my American perspective and my identity.
Great. Well, we'll get back to some of the things you learned about methane and other things later. I'd like to ask Mike Haas, about 20 years ago, you started to become aware you were getting a PhD, you get involved in energy. So tell us about your path to founding the Alliance for Climate Education.
Sure. Never finished my PhD. I think maybe two or three people in the world cared about what I was working on, and I decided I wasn't one of them because... I started becoming far more aware of the risks of CO2 concentrations and started worrying about the atmosphere. And as an aerodynamicist at the time, I was thinking, what's an aerodynamicist to do about this? Got drawn into renewable energy, so did that for a while. Was fortunate to start a couple of small companies, and over the course of about 10 years, put a lot of wind energy projects in service in the U.S. and in the U.K. But it sort of struck me. I was at a panel like this, and I was a renewable guy, and there was a Mr. Carbon. He wasn't 12 years old. He was a natural gas exec somewhere. But I was a renewable guy on an energy panel. Somebody asked me, how much wind have you done? And I tried to explain it in megawatts, which is kind of a hard thing to understand. He said, well, all the plants you built Like, how many homes could that power in a year? And I thought about it for a bit and kind of came up rough numbers, sort of 1 million or 1.5 million homes worth of electricity that the wind projects that I'd done. And there was a little polite applause in the audience, I suppose. But I came home and I was really unsettled because I felt like I got into this because I came to the conclusion this was a very big risk with extraordinary consequences. And I felt like I wasn't moving the needle far enough or fast enough, and decided that the only way that we're going to be successful in taking the actions that we need to, I think, are have to begin with education. I think you've got to invest in that. We've got to bridge the gap between what scientists know about the threat and what the general public understands. And I think that the most effective way and the quickest way to get there is to invest in young people. They deserve to know what the scientists have concluded. And they're just not getting it in our schools. That's not to say there aren't some terrific teachers in schools doing amazing work, but for the most part, they're not getting this. And I think it's hard to develop the will to make this a priority without the information. And so that kind of led me to start ACE. And happy to be sitting actually next to, which I found out in the conference room, Rosemary, who I think was a freshman at one of our first assemblies in 2009 at Berkeley High. So
great to have been inspired.
Yeah.
So tell us briefly about the organization. You present high school demonstrations by high schoolers to high schoolers around the country, and then we'll ask Carlene to come up and we'll continue. But tell us a little bit about...
Educators a bit north. So they're typically sort of maybe just out of college. So they're okay. Young 20-somethings. But we have educators that go into high schools and give assembly presentations. That's our first engagement. In about 3 years, we've been in front of about 1.5 million high school students. So we've demonstrated that if you tell this story right, it's a story that you have to really tell right. It's hard to see the villain, right? But if you tell the story right, young people engage. Young people, you can shoot straight with young people. You can tell them what the scientists have concluded. And then more importantly, you can tell them what solutions there are out there and what opportunities this will open up in addressing what will be a big challenge for them. And so it begins with these educators that go and do these pretty cool, you know, a lot of music and video and animation assembly presentations. And our educators follow back up with students in clubs that we form to take on projects in their schools and communities.
And Rosemary, do you remember seeing this presentation when you were at Berkeley High School?
I do, yeah, twice actually.
Ah.
Yeah.
And what impact did it have?
So it had an impact on the environmental club that I was a part of, Eco Community Club at the time. And so we started doing the Biggest Loser competition
right.
last year. And that, although we never really got to complete it because of a lack of involvement, it's
shame.
Still, it's shame. Nothing. You know, you got to, like, make young people feel connected to these issues. And then, like, really, I think... For me, at least, in the beginning, it was hard to be like, climate change, why is it important? Why should I care? But once you, I guess, when you bridge that, you really hit something special.
But you're saying it's tough to sustain a level of concern and engagement,
yeah.
right? Because people move on to other things.
Mm-hmm. And they tend to put it on the back burner from, like, my general impressions. Like, you put it on the back burner for the economy, for politics. But the thing is, all these issues are interconnected. So it's more complicated.
Bridger Murray, do you find that too sometimes? It's like, well, sometimes you recycle, sometimes you don't. It's tough to keep up the commitment.
Yeah, and then sometimes, you know, it's like, not, it's, you know, why should I recycle? I mean, it's not like, it's not making, I can't see visually an impact or anything, but then when you look into it, I guess, you know, it all adds up and it can lead to an apocalyptic environment, really, so.
Bridger Murray, I've been doing this 5 years, is the youngest guest I've ever had her appear on stage. So please give him a round of applause for doing this. Bridger Murray, and we're going to ask Bridger and Carlene. Very impressive. Sixth grader, 12 years old, very impressive. So Carlene Cullen's going to join us now, and she is the founder of the Cool the Earth campaign. And Carlene, I'd like to ask you welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask you the same question. How did you become sort of climate conscious and get into founding Cool the Earth campaign?
Well, you asked me probably the most difficult question of the evening in that
I wasn't very climate aware.
You saw an inconvenient truth, and you were a skeptic and said it was overblown.
I saw an inconvenient truth, and I thought, this just simply couldn't be real. You know, and so at first I thought, this isn't happening. Let me go back and do some research. But it really wasn't the science that got me. This is a personal story that I don't know how many people saw an inconvenient truth, but you know, Al Gore nearly lost his son, and he shared that with us in the movie. And about 3 years prior, my husband and I also had nearly lost our son, who was three at the time. And you know, I sat there in that film, and I just thought, I can't let this happen to my children. I've experienced this. I sat by the hospital bed for weeks, not knowing the outcome. And it took me in such a way, and I thought, what am I doing with my life? If I'm aware of what's happening, if the science is right, I have to take action. And I believe that children, like Bridger, younger children, you know, we work with K through 8, that they have an ability to embrace the topic, to take charge of their own future, and to have an intergenerational approach to this issue, because everybody says, well, little kids, what are they going to learn? By the time they grow up, it'll be too late. So we have an intergenerational approach where the kids get engaged with the cliffhanger of the assembly, which I love that, because it really is a cliffhanger in that, you know, in the end, the polar bears are saying, you know, the one polar bear is wearing an iPod and dancing around and saying, hey, kids, are you going to do something, or will you help me? And Mr. Carbon's saying, no, forget about them. And it's up to the kids to make a difference and to engage their families in the action.
And yet we don't know how this story is going to turn out. Mm-hmm. And some would say we are headed toward a cliff on carbon if we keep going the rate we're going. You also have some stories in Kentfield where, so your program is in schools. There was a case in Kentfield where a parent found out about it, didn't like it. The Republican National Committee got involved. Tell us about that.
Well, we had moved from New York City, where I thought I'd seen it all. We lived there for 20 years, and we started this. We wanted to just take action at our kids' elementary school and just bring a local, something we had developed, something I developed and wrote some plays, et cetera, and the coupon book. And, you know, we had the approval of the superintendent, the school principals, et cetera. And at the last minute, one of the school board members objected and said the whole plan had to be canceled, and it was suddenly in the press, and the Republican National Committee became involved, and you know, eventually we've had things, the Drudge Report has picked up on it, the Wall Street Journal has written things, you know, I was so naive, I got a call from a Wall Street Journal journalist, and I thought it was one of my friends from New York, it was a 212 area code. And they said to Wall Street Journal, I'm like, yeah, right. And she said, no, really, I'm the Wall Street Journal. And I'd like to interview you for a story, this was about 5 years ago, about kids and climate. Of course, with the Drudge Report and the Wall Street Journal, they were all very negative slant on climate change and engaging families in climate.
And there was even one man in Novato who was arrested for harassing someone involved in...
It's one of the principals at one of the schools became so harassed that she finally had to call the police on one of the parents to say that, you know, this was turning into a big problem. We had, for a number of years at every school, some skeptic who was very vocal about the program and would bring in computer slideshows to show the school elementary school principal why the climate science was wrong. And, you know, that's diminished over the past year and a half. I'm not exactly sure why, but we don't run into resistance. We've only been kicked out of one school, and everybody can probably guess what state that was in, which was Texas. but we're in 23 states. We just ran last year in Shawnee, Kansas, one of the most successful schools we've had. So it's definitely become a more accepted program.
I don't want to dwell on the resistance, but Mike Haas, you also have a story of a Texas school where the TV truck showed up, and there's, you know, these things can get really right. Excited.
Maybe slightly unfair, you know, to be focusing on Texas. As it happened, it was a year that we were launching. Similar story. One of our educators came in. It was a school not quite the size of Berkeley High, 1,500 kids. I think they did 4 or 5 assemblies. These are 1-hour assemblies. Went great. You know, it was really deeply appreciated. These assemblies are offered at no cost. They address science standards in various states. And the next morning, our lead educator in the area got a call around 5 a.m. from the assistant principal, who was sort of the gatekeeper and arranged to have us in. And I think he'd, you know, received 100 emails, you know, since 9 o'clock that night, had Channel 7 news truck idling in front of the school. And again, that's definitely an exception. We've found for the most part that, you know, schools embrace this, that but they just need someone to offer it. And I think schools also recognize, as we do, how important it is to invest in young people. I mean, they've got an authenticity, a sincerity. They're forming behaviors, impressions for life. And I think, you know, that's why we typically don't have these types of issues, but it happens once in a while.
All right, let's move on. One of the themes we often talk about here at Climate One is the balance between hope and fear in terms of motivation, messaging, et cetera. Because you look at the science, some of this is really scary, but there's a lot of hope and optimism. So I'd like to ask all of you, sort of in your own messaging and communication, how do you balance that hope and fear? Because a little of both, and perhaps different people respond differently. Mike, you know, how do you balance that?
Again, we focus on high school students. So we're in 2,000 high schools probably around the country. And we take the approach that we're a science-based organization, and we think, again, that the young people deserve to hear what the consensus science is on this issue, understand the risk. And we think it's important to shoot straight with young people. They can handle it. And so we do focus a bit on what some of the consequences might look like, particularly in their areas. You know, making it local, telling the story right, seeing how it will impact them, not in 30 years, but even today, some of these impacts. But we don't dwell on it. We put it there because we think it's important that they get a sense of the urgency. Why should this be a priority? As Rosemary said, there's a lot of things that aren't right in the world. Why should this be a priority? So we do point that out. But then we focus far more on solutions, far more on the paths, the opportunities they can take. It is really hard. We've heard that from both Bridger and Rosemary. I think this is a challenging problem. I think it's easy to disengage. It's easy to be overwhelmed. And to think, what in the heck can I do, you know, sort of on my own? That's why we put so much faith in young people, to try and build a connected community, you know, starting their school, branching out in their region, so that they feel they're not alone. There are a lot of young people out there that feel this way, and I believe young people, again, give us our best opportunity to create the space and let our leaders know that it's safe to do the right thing, to mitigate this risk.
We'll get Carlene on hope and fear in a minute, but Rosemary, Mike mentioned sort of local impacts. How will climate change affect Berkeley High School? We have high school students in the audience from high schools around the Bay Area. How will climate change affect Berkeley High and other high school students, people in high school today?
Okay, so the Bay Area is obviously going to be affected by the sea level rising, and for Berkeley High School, a lot about the climate conditions too. And you know, high schools across the world are going to be having to confront this problem, and you're also going to have to confront the problems of the families of these students too, who rely on our environment. So up in the Arctic, whether it's subsistence and whether if it's based on hunting and it's based on the trade there, or even here where people are employed by like the Richmond Refinery or by nonprofits. So really, it's kind of like everyone, it affects anyone. It's inescapable because we're already in nature and we're already in the environment, and it's already happening too. So I guess there's a lot of fear that like there's going to be resistance, and it's like with any idea, like there's obviously going to be some opposition, but there's a consensus that we have to see that climate change is real and that we have an impact on it and that we can change. We can change our anthropogenic effects. We can change our human consequences. So there's hope. There's definitely hope.
So, Carlene, back to hope and fear. You deal with younger kids, and some
yes.
people say it's not appropriate to scare younger children.
Right,
so
right.
So you've got to balance differently than maybe the high schoolers
might. With the exception of my own children who I want to scare,
yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So when we started this, I went and consulted with some principals, lots of school teachers, moms, had a mom advisory group to talk about how we bring these serious topics to young children. And one of the things that we do is that we also are a free program, is that a parent or a teacher volunteer at that local school actually runs the program. And the teachers are typically the characters on stage donning these polar bear hats and Mr. or Miss Carbon costumes. So they're people that the students are very familiar with already. It's a certain trust built into that. But secondly, you're familiar with Tom and Jerry?
Yes, sure. Yeah,
the cartoons.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, our assembly is a is basically a big Tom and Jerry copy of Tom and Jerry. You know, you've got Mr. Carbon chasing after the polar
bear. Slapstick fun.
It's cartoonish. It's very silly. The kids are never afraid, but they come out and they know what carbon dioxide is. They know what methane is. They know about renewable energies. They know about the importance of electric vehicles, but all in a very fun, upbeat way. And most importantly, they know when they walk out of there that they can use the coupon book or not, like Bridger, he just took action. You know, they can, I don't care, take the actions. They can use this coupon book that can help them know how they can reduce their carbon emissions and ways that they can also engage their parents in reducing the carbon emissions. Because trying to get adults to pay attention to this when they've got busy lives, even parents who are concerned but can't take a step back to take action, but their kids can come in, and when they learn about this together, then they can really start moving forward as a family. So it's really no fear at all at this age level.
And there's a number of very prominent stories of children who've gotten to their parents, who are very influential. John Doerr in Silicon Valley. We had recently Bob Inglis, former Republican congressman from South Carolina, was a climate denier when his first term in Congress. One of his daughters got a hold of him and flipped him, and now he lost his congressional seat partly because he said, I'm a Republican and I believe in the science. So kids getting to their parents can be highly effective. I'd like to ask Mike Haas, how do you measure the impact? You know, you could have a really, you know, Rosemary is here a couple years after hearing the presentation. It seems like it had an impact on her life. She was already on this path. But how do you know that this stays with people down the road when you've got 1 hour perhaps with a student out of a very busy...
So we got together with... a few of the sort of the experts in the world in terms of how to communicate climate science. And we came up with some surveys that we go in to test this, because you're absolutely right. Are we doing a good thing?
Lasting impact.
Yeah. A lasting impact, right. Because what we're trying to do is get started on a path to behavior change, and that's hard. It is hard, but we need to do it. It's just because it's hard doesn't mean we can't try to do it. What we try to do with these assemblies is to create an extraordinarily memorable experience so that they have a first, for some of them it may be the first time that they've been in front of something like this, and some that have heard it before, maybe we've connected the dots in a different way, so it's more lasting and meaningful. But that first memorable experience, an awakening moment, what we do is we measure surveys. So we've gone out and done thousands of pre-assembly surveys and then post-assembly surveys after the assembly, and then in some deferred periods of time, to measure, knowledge, but more importantly, attitudes and behaviors. And what we've seen is, among the 1.5 million students that we've been in front of, our analysis is that we've got something like sort of a 50% shift in attitudes and behaviors. So taking people from disengaged to concerned, from concerned to alarmed. And we think that, and the researchers that have looked at this, have never seen anything like it in a 1 hour engagement. They've seen shifts like this in terms of attitude and behaviors, but over maybe many months or many years with multiple intervention points. And I think, again, it comes down to telling the story right. So is it enough? No. Is it necessary? We believe that it is. It's this first memorable experience, but then what we got to do, and that's why our educators go back and continue to work with the kids afterwards.
It's a fantastic presentation. It's on the web. I've seen it a couple times live. It's been to my son's school. I highly recommend it to anyone who hasn't seen it. Carlene, how do you measure the impact? I don't know if you had time to yet to know that when kids get into high school, are they still remembering Mr. Carbon?
We don't have that sort of longitudinal study yet. But about 2 years ago, we collaborated with some researchers at Stanford University who did a full year-long evaluation, three-phase evaluation of the program. And some of the things that they discovered were, number one, that the kids were engaged, but also that they went home and told their parents about what was happening at school with climate change and with the assembly. And we also found out, we did some focus groups, or they did some focus groups with parents, and over again, the moms largely would report in and say, my kid comes home and says, you know, I'm only using these sorts of water bottles, or we need to reduce our carbon emissions, and, you know, to some kind of funny things where they're taking a shower and it's supposed to take a 7-minute shower and the kid's banging on the door saying, it's time to get out, you know. So, you know, mostly good things, but it's a really great symbiotic relationship because parents have reported that, of course, they're aware of climate change, but they really hadn't made the time. So they work together to remind each other in the household. And that in and of itself extends the length of the program, the length of the impact. I think looking forward, we have an opportunity that we think will extend the life of the program significantly. And I'm not sure if I should go into that or wait a little bit.
I think you're looking at games. And games is a way that's one thing that's interesting in terms of making these funds and fun and sort of the, you know, video game where it's, you know, Rosemary talked about the biggest loser. Right. How can games be a factor?
Right. Yeah, so one of the things that I am frustrated by is that we need to get there faster. We need to keep expanding. We know the program works. We found out through the Stanford evaluation that 38% of the parents said that after the program concluded, they went on to take more expensive retrofits, they thought about green purchases, and they got engaged civically. They wrote to their newspaper, wrote to a local elected official. So we wanted to keep expanding that, but reaching more and more students, more and more families. And we have just announced recently that we are partnering with Guitar Hero, the founders of Guitar Hero, which is the number one grossing game in the world ever. And the two founders of that are going to be partnering with us. They're personal friends of mine. And we're working on bringing all the mechanisms that we've learned over the past few years, the past 6 years from Cool the Earth's school-based program, and bringing that in to where kids live. Which is on their PDAs or their mom and dad's iPhones or iPads, but still having that same interaction. There's going to be a story about polar bears and Mr. Carbon. There will be actions they can take from the clouds. There will be things the families can do, and they'll be using some fun technology to authenticate that they took action, some photojournaling or Instagram sort of technology. So it's an exciting project, and we just learned that we're in advanced stages, is the language, with the MacArthur Foundation for funding this project. So we're very excited about that.
Well, let's ask Rosemary and also Michael about, can being green be fun?
Being green can totally be fun. I mean, I don't see why not. I mean, okay, I'm in university right now, and one of the fun things that I do is the Residence Hall Council. I'm a programming coordinator. So last semester we had a really fun before finals event. It was Swap When You're Swamped. So, and basically people would come and they would party and there was an open mic and there was live music, coffee, and people could swap stuff. Like people could trade, like, hey, oh my god, I really like that shawl of yours, I'll trade my fan for it. You know, there's that kind of interaction and that you don't have to be such a huge consumer to be happy. Like money isn't happiness. Like, and you can form these interpersonal connections with green. And then sometimes green, it seems so fun that it isn't green. I mean, so it's like stuff like fun outdoor sports, like orienteering, or just like programming, or like just talking green too, and like saying, oh my god, have you heard about the ozone layer today? Or have you heard about that really cool sea mollusk? And then like connecting the dots and being like, wow, this is green, this is environmental. And then you find this like really innate environmental stewardship that I guess you don't even have to create, you just have, it's in you.
Mike, Rosemary mentioned DOT, and DOT is part of the Alliance for Climate Education campaign, Do One Thing, because this thing, climate becomes so big and so overwhelming, as Bridger mentioned earlier. Does what I do matter? Where do I start? And so Do One Thing is a very clever way that you sort of get people on the path.
Well, it's one of the immediate asks at our assembly presentations. Aside from, you know, coming in and forming a club if they don't have an environmental club, everybody can do one thing. We think, you know, one step, taking one step is the thing that can most ensure that you take a second one. And if you take a second one, there's a better chance you're going to take a third one. So, and we don't prescribe what that is. We leave it up to the people. But you know, to your point, can this be fun? I think that is such a key point, because what we need to recognize is that people have different interests, people have different passion, people have different things that motivate them. We share this common bond of this risk, but it's important to meet people where they are, whether you're a performer, right? Whether you're an aerodynamicist or aerodynamicist to be a baseball player. Bridger, tell me about his baseball team. We have football teams, you know, plant trees to offset their carbon impact. We've had fashion shows, you know, put on by students. So whether you're into the science, whether you're into the performing arts, whether you're into athletics, whether you're into civics,
saving money,
to find
some
your
people
voice,
are motivated.
Whether you're into just saving money, absolutely, through efficiency, energy efficiency things, you've got to meet people where they're at, and we think that's the best single way to develop this community so that you don't have this feeling of, I'm on my own, what difference can it possibly make? Mm-hmm. You know, we need to draw people and meet them where they're at, and that's what we think is very important that the young people really get and they respond to when you meet them where they're at.
If you're just joining us, Mike Haas is the founder of Alliance for Climate Education. Our other guests today at Climate One are Rosemary Davies, a university student at Chatham University in Pittsburgh and a graduate of Berkeley High School's Green Academy, and Carlene Cullen, founder and executive director of Cool the Earth. I'm Greg Dalton. You can listen to this and other Climate One shows on iTunes, podcasts on iTunes. Sometimes environmentalism is seen as an elite pursuit. It's for people on the coast. It's for people in upper income brackets. Rosemary Davies, is that true? Is this something that, caring about the environment is a luxury if you've got a job and a certain level of living?
I think it is, because a lot of times when you're on a lower socioeconomic status, when you're poor, climate isn't really at the top of your list. You're more like, can I meet like housing for next week? Can I keep this job? And I think that definitely when you have wealth and you can live well, you have time to think about climate, but and also to be green too. But the thing is, green applies to all people of all walks of life. So I come from a very frugal family, and we're not exactly very wealthy, but we're not exactly really poor, and it's hard to say if we're middle class or not. But we have an online book business, and it's being green really helps, because we go to Costco sometimes not to buy, but just to like roam through the aisles and collect cardboard. It's like one of the most fun things ever. It's like shopping for cardboard, but shopping for free. And so we use that to wrap our books, and it makes the whole process easier for us. And recycling is easy too. Reuse is even easier. So, like, being green is hard when you have so many other things to work for, and it's kind of like beating that paycheck. But there is a part of green where it's everywhere. Everywhere at once.
Carlene, are you in liberal upper income neighborhoods and schools?
Well, we are in some, yes. And about 30% of our schools are lower income schools. And so we have all of our materials in Mandarin and Spanish. And we see about the same rate of return of actions from those. But I wanted to say something about the elite, the rich, and environmentalism, because I think that was perhaps true 20 years ago or 30 years ago before climate came into the picture. And now, unfortunately, or not, that same group are actually typically the worst carbon offenders. And it's actually the lower in the socioeconomic scale that have a smaller carbon footprint, that care a little bit more about their gas bills and their utility bills. And I think that it's the messaging that's appropriate to get to the variety of people. I all the time am talking to foundations or potential funders who are interested in low-income communities, and we feel like the knowledge needs to be there, the education, the opportunity, but that we also really need to address this upper echelon who maybe feel they're green because they're flying to some open space to go hike, and that's a huge carbon footprint. So it's really turned, climate change has really turned some of those.
We've heard about those 8,000 square foot green homes in Marin. Yeah, and Mike Haas, also, the people who are on the lower income levels are the most vulnerable, and they're going to be hit hardest in many respects and have less of a buffer and cushion.
No, I think that's right. And I think, you know, the science isn't going to care a whole lot of who's wealthy or not. The wealthy certainly probably are going to be able to handle the consequences certainly better than those that are less fortunate. But you're absolutely right that it's those that are least equipped to handle this that are going to have the hardest time with it, which again is why we believe that it's very important that everyone has an opportunity to understand what the scientists are saying. Our programs, you mentioned the left coast and the right coast. We're in a whole lot of states in between, not just the coast. And about two-thirds of the schools that we go into are public schools. About half of those are on some federal assist for lunch programs, things like that. So we think it's actually, which I'm sure you'd agree, it's not one or the other. It's all that we need to make sure that, those that have the best capacity to handle this understand what's going on, and those with the least. And that to solve this problem, we're going to need everybody. We're going to need everybody to understand, everybody to come together.
And that includes students. So in some schools, clearly there's a bell curve. There's sort of the middle, and there's some real advocates, people highly engaged, perhaps like Rosemary and Bridger. So are you trying to get a few leaders that then really go on, or are you after the whole population along the spectrum of engagement?
Sort of both. We're building a pipeline. So we've been in front of about 1.5 million students. Out of those, there's probably, out of a typical assembly of ours, a couple hundred students, let's say, 5, 10, 20, 25 students will come down afterwards, truly inspired, want to do something, right? And so we focus very much on that group that come down that are inspired after this first memorable experience of the assembly, and we invest heavily to try to help them become leaders where they're at, whether it's in the arts or the athletics or civics or what it is. We support them to find where their best opportunities are to become a leader. So we invest heavily post-assembly with those students that come down that that really want to do something, but through virtual engagement and sort of grassroots with those leaders, they go back into the schools and engage the rest of the crowd. That hopefully have been introduced to this concept. They're thinking toward that. Our analysis shows that is indeed the case. But we got these grassroots leaders in the schools that will keep this alive after this first assembly experience. And just one final point, there's something like 20 million high school students at any given time, or if not in high school, unfortunately some of them not, but in this sort of age range, 14 to 18. So 20 million, 5 million a year, entering our civic society. And so we think it is so important to make sure the young people have a chance to make this a priority.
That's why we're happy to see so many young people in the room and on stage. I sit here and talk to people with gray hair like me, and we're talking about the future, but they're not part of the conversation or they're not in the room. So we're especially pleased to have you all here today. We're going to go to audience questions in a minute, but first I want to ask you about your own carbon footprint and your own lifestyle. So what have you done?
I have to leave now.
Carlene, I saw you drive up in a Hummer, Carlene. So tell us what you've done.
My helicopter dropped me off.
Yes, we do have a helipad on the roof. So tell us what you've done about your own personal carbon footprint.
Yeah. Well, so when we started Cool the Earth, it was about the same time that we decided that we wanted to move to solar PV on our rooftop. And that we also wanted to have an expandable rack that we could add more if we decided to buy an electric vehicle, which we did 5 weeks ago, and I love it. So if you haven't tried one, you definitely should. It's fantastic.
And you have a Nissan Leaf, which I have.
Leaf, drove in from Marin with a few other people, and it was fantastic. So we tried to attack some of the big things that we could do first, and then in small ways throughout the day, making sure we cold water wash, all those things that you would expect that one would do. But I think perhaps the most important thing I do with my carbon footprint is that we've reached 250,000 kids and their families who have taken 250,000 actions. And I think that that's, personally probably the most valuable thing.
That's great. Food, transportation, solar. Where a lot of people get hung up on this is air travel
and
flying. Yes. I'm guilty of this as anyone. I've done all those things, electric car, less meat, solar on the roof. But, we've taken some discretionary family trips, which, honestly, we maybe, didn't need to take.
Air travel is by far the biggest problem, I think, and the things that we don't have many options for. We do things that my kids really dislike, but when we go see the grandparents in LA, we drive our Prius. And, you know, they're sitting here going, everybody else is flying. But, you know, we can get there on about a tank of gas. Uh-huh. And so we make all of those trips. We try to really make anything that's reasonable that we drive the gas guzzler of the Prius.
My kids are looking on with worry, but okay. Rosemary?
I'm guilty of air travel, too, because I'm across the country in Pennsylvania, so I have to take a plane here and I'll have to take a plane back. But definitely my university has been really paramount in being green and making the students kind of green, too. We don't sell bottled water. All our food in our cafeteria is organic and it's locally produced. We're also having our first sustainable campus called Eden Hall. It's going to come about in the next 10 years. And it's really neat because it's going to be zero net energy, which I'm looking forward to. Although I'm sure that I'm going to be an alumni by then. I'll be old and wrinkled, but...
I don't think so. I might be an alumni.
But it's going it's going to take some time. But also, like, my student ID is a bus pass, so I take the bus a lot, Port Authority to, like, wherever. Like, there's so many districts in Pittsburgh. I can't even, like, name them all. But, and then also, just, there's a lot of initiatives on campus, and nearly everyone you meet is going to be an environmentalist. We're also, one of our main alumni is Rachel Carson, so she's definitely left a lasting impact. Even our mascot is called Carson the Cougar, so I mean, it's hard. It would be hard not to be green there.
Mike Haas, what have you done?
Won't repeat some of the same.
You've also built
only shower about every 3 days, which drives my wife kind of nuts. The boys don't mind. But, no, but seriously, I think that, you know, it is important to sort of walk the, you know, to walk the right way. But I also believe that we're not going to crack this through conservation. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. We're going to have to crack this, I think, through legislation. I think this is a big enough challenge that we've got to get there through legislation, not just through conservation. Don't get me wrong. We should all be doing everything we possibly can. And so I feel the same way that Carlene, that I feel like the most important thing that I'm doing is trying to bridge the gap, as I said earlier, between what the scientists understand and what the public understands, and focusing on young people. Because again, you can have you and me sitting up there, no offense, you know, but you take a bridger and you take some of the young people that we've worked with, then they don't move the room. And there's still an element of we got to pull at the heartstrings on this one. So to have a chance of addressing this right, I think we've got to build the will. We've got to make this a priority. And I'll continue showering only every few days, but that's the most important thing that I'm going to try to keep doing.
All right, I think I'll join you. Okay. Let's invite audience participation. We're going to we have a microphone here, and we're going to invite you to come up and present one part question or comment. This is often the most lively part of it, and we encourage you, if anyone's a student in the audience, a little bit reticent, we're really, really happy to see you participate in this. And once the first student steps up, others will likely follow. So encourage that first brave one. So let's include our audience questions. Well, yes, sir. Welcome to Climate One.
Thank you very much. As an aged student, Mike and Carlene, hi, guys. I've heard you talk a lot about solutions and things, but what I haven't heard tonight about is adaptation, and I'm curious how you're incorporating the adaptation message with our young folks.
Adaptation being bracing for impacts that are coming our way regardless. Mike Haas?
I'll take a quick start. We're really focused on mitigation. I mean, to us, it's about mitigation. However, you're absolutely right that we're shooting straight with young people. They deserve that. But we believe that if we focus on, you know, what the scientists are saying, things that they can do, you know, they will also learn about certain consequences that we may not be able to get in front of. But it's all about mitigation. But by learning how important this is, you learn sort of about the consequences and what people can do to deal with it. But we believe that, you know, for everything we can do to mitigate, it's going to pay off multiples and factors in terms of having to deal with adaptation. So we're really all about mitigation.
And mitigation is one of those Latin-rooted words, which means like reducing the actual
carbon.
Yeah,
reducing CO2. So it's all about trying to bring down levels of CO2, and that's what our focus is. But they understand, obviously, that if we don't, that there's going to be a whole lot more adapting to do, but we don't want to go there yet.
Carleen Cullen?
Yes. So we also are largely a mitigation program, so you know, actions and attitudes. But with the parents, we have oftentimes taken an additional approach, which is to talk to them about adaptation. One of my favorite things to do is in the Bay Area is to get the BCDC map of the flood zones and to have this out at a fundraiser or a little party. And, you know, you see everybody with their up-close magnifying glass trying to identify where their house is and if it will be underwater. And it is one of the best tools to get people to start mitigating because they start learning about what are we going to have to do personally to adapt and what's the whole Bay Area going to have to do.
There's also one of those Bay Conservation and Development Commission maps that has the headquarters of the technology companies, and that gets your attention when you see where Yahoo and Oracle and Google are relative to sea level rise. Let's have our next audience question. Welcome to Climate One.
Hi, I'm T-Von. I was just wondering if you guys do private schools yet, like Cool the Earth?
Yes. We like all schools. So private schools, public schools, Montessori schools, any sort of... we're K through 8, we'd love to bring your school in.
And what grade are you in, may we ask?
I'm in 6th, and I went to Wade Thomas last year, so we had Cool the Earth.
Okay. Great. Thanks for coming to Climate One. Let's have our next audience question.
Hi, I'm Edmund, and I'm in 11th grade. I'm in my Green Academy at my high school, and in our Green Academy, we learn about how small actions can contribute to like a big impact. And I was just wondering, what do you expect in the next 10 to 20 years, maybe, what your little actions can, how they can affect impact the future.
Rosemary?
Okay, so it's really true. Like, alone we're just but a drop, but together we're like a flood. So what we do right now, like shutting off the lights when we don't need them, like the do one thing, like vampire, I think it's like Vampire slayers, yeah, being a vampire slayer. Like being
vampires
conscious
are,
about what
Explain what vampires are.
Oh, vampires, basically, when you put your plug in to this out socket and you're not really needing it, it's still using energy, so you're going to unplug that sucker right out and you save energy, which is good. In general, I mean, there's no bad things, right, about conserving energy, which is good. But and then we were already seeing, like, impacts of what, like, the past has done, and we can certainly see those in the future. Like with bioaccumulation, especially in the Arctic, because a lot of like the wind and ocean currents bring a lot of that pollution in. So we're definitely seeing impacts there, and also in hunting and the species distribution. Like there's tons of impacts that we're already seeing and what we can also expect to see in the future. Although we hope to mitigate that as a whole generation and as a whole past generation too, because we still have everyone with us.
Rosemary Davies is a graduate of Berkeley High School Green Academy here at Climate One today. Did you have anything to add?
Oh, I was just going to say that I think as new technologies are developed, ones that are already present and emerging and new ones coming forward, those will become the norm. And the younger generation will just see those as basic as having an iPhone, and that's not going to be anything out of the norm. And you know, one of the best things was my 11-year-old daughter had a friend over last week, and I was upstairs, and I heard her say to another friend, "Hey, you guys got to come see this car. It's totally sick." And it was my Leaf that they were going out to see. And, you know, here are some 11-year-old girls, sick being a good thing, and, you know, wanting to see this great car. And so I think that that's kind of what's happening, and that's what's going to be emerging as we go forward.
Fantastic. Let's have our next question. Welcome. Hi.
Thank you. I'm Mina, and I'm a 10th grader at Lake Wilmerding High School. I am a co-leader of our environmental club, and we've been having little issues getting off the ground. I think a big problem for us is that our school is actually pretty green already. We have a big emphasis on it in our classes, some of our mandatory classes. There's a big unit on climate change. And I feel like a big problem for our school is that students, they think, oh, recycling, reducing, oh, turn off the lights, blah, blah, blah. And then they're like, well, how does this affect anything? And everything green just turns into sort of like this big mosh. And they're like, they don't understand like the connection between not using that extra piece of paper and the world in general. And they think, well, since our school is already doing such a good job because, oh, look, there's solar panels on our roofs, we don't have to do anything. And it's kind of like this attitude where they're like, oh, well, look, we're doing pretty well. We're in San Francisco. We're not in, like, oh, say, that state over there where, oh, they've never even heard of green energy, you know? And I was just wondering your thoughts on sort of, like, bring sort of motivation.
Thank you. Yeah, so there's... If you do one green deed, does that buy you a license to do all sorts of other things?
Not at all. I think green is not like a point in time. It's more like a process, and it's more of a goal. And so I think it's hard when you're in like a community that like already has that like label of being green to like burst that bubble and be like, oh my God, there's communities that don't know what green is, or like that, oh my God, I'm still having an impact here. Or like getting out in the community where people really haven't really heard the word green and haven't made the connection, and also maintaining what green is and trying to still remain a steward and retain that responsibility, because as green as you are, you're still going to have an impact.
And if I could maybe just add to that, please come wherever you want. Please come and talk to me after this, because one of the best things you can do is be a leader to others. So if your school's doing great, I would suggest there's probably still more to be done, but one of the best things you can do is be a model school. This is all about storytelling, and a lot of other high schools can get inspired by what you've done. When they see that there's young people, you know, at a different school doing this stuff, you can be a leader. And so, and we can help you do that. So that's one of the best things you can do, is just be a role model for other schools and tell the story right to them, to inspire them to come up to your level.
Let's have our next question. Welcome. Hi.
Hi, Andrea Wallace. I'm Montgomery High School in Santa Rosa. I'm also the president of our green team there. So we actually just had a waste audit in 12-12-12, and that was a lot of fun, sorting through trash. And we actually recently just put in compost bins. So.
Nice, a waste audit and compost bins. All right.
I actually had a couple questions. That's all right. What about putting solar panels on airplanes? And the other one was the vacuumed air blimps.
So. Mike Haas, you're the PhD up here, so
never finished it. Dropped out. Slightly hard to imagine, but let me say this: that is exactly, you've demonstrated exactly a point, and this age group, right, that we're kind of talking about, don't quash them, don't hold them back, give them the information. Let them know what's out there and let them innovate. Let them put their creativity, their innovative spirit to use. And I may sit here and say, well, I don't see that happening. And there's going to be some 14 or 15-year-old that's going to crack it if that's a good idea. So the solutions that will come from young people who recognize that this is a way to help solve this problem, right? I can't even imagine what those look like. What I know is there's plenty we can do right now, today. We don't have to wait. But the creativity and the innovative spirit that's going to come from this age group that do not like the word no, right? Don't want to. I didn't like it a long time ago when I was that age, and that hadn't changed. They don't like to hear the word no. They're going to innovate out of this, but they've got to understand what's at stake and that there are paths to get there.
Fabulous. Hi, welcome to Climate One. Step up to the mic. Yeah, thank you.
I'm one of the other leaders of Lick Wilmerding High School's Environmental Club, and I also agree that we've had some trouble, but this question's a bit different. Like, I heard it's important to get legislation through on all these topics, like how they're talking about the legislation of the XL pipeline and stuff like that. How can young kids like us get involved in the legislative side of it, since like I only recently turned 18 and finally got to vote, but I know a lot of kids who are younger than me who know just about as much as I know, maybe more about some of these topics, but because they aren't 18 yet, they aren't able to put any of their influence into legislation, and I just wondered if there's a way that we can get our voices heard in the legislative side.
You write a letter to your congressman, but don't put your age on it. But yeah, okay.
Well, you know, one thing I would say first is, you know, we don't view this as a political issue. This is a human issue. But you know, I did say that I believe that this is something that we're going to need our leaders to help solve, and it has to be solved through legislation, civic engagement. This isn't just a science education. There's a civics education here as well. You know, as Carlene said, you can't vote yet if you're less than 18. Family, friends, others, talk to them about it. You'll be surprised how receptive parents are when their kids come up to them and want to talk about something. I'm finding it myself, you know, with my kids. And, you know, furthermore, you're not that far, you know, from when you'll be able to sort of be able to exercise your democratic rights. And then lastly, and this is one of the things that we do with high school students, we plug them into organizations so that as you do become a bit older, a lot of options out there, a lot of organizations that will give a chance if civics, if activism is a path that you want to blossom into in terms of your own leadership, what you're going to do about this, lots of organizations and groups that are out there and again, opportunities that we try to point out to young people to be able to engage.
Carlene Cullen?
Yeah. I think also I would say Google. That would be the first thing I would do is, you know, go online, find other youth groups that are taking action, join in. There's a Excel pipeline a protest coming up in very soon. I forgot the exact date of it. There's one in D.C., and there's one also here in San Francisco. So join in on those things. You don't have to be a certain age. I bring my kids all the time, and, you know, they're young. So just showing up in person to support some of these initiatives, that's something that you can do at any age.
I agree with Carlene, too, because, like, protest is a really important part of social change because the government is for and by the people. And one way that, like, you can get involved is, like, at marches. Like, I remember there was an I Matter march, like, a year ago that I went to, and that really, like put me on the front lines. And, like, although I couldn't vote at the time, you're still involved. So it's important to look at that opportunity, too.
Let's have our next question. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much. My name is Clara Vondrich. All of you, thank you for what you're doing. It's so important. And Rosemary in particular, I just wanted to say that you are so inspiring. Please keep your idealism, because I came out of high school all fired up as well, and I still am fired up, but it's amazing how after the years and being in the quote-unquote real world, you start to get pressured to adapt your views and to be a little bit less idealistic. So I'm just encouraging you to keep that up. My question is about Bill McKibben. He's one of my big heroes, and I understand that he's going around college campuses all around the country, and he's making quite a splash with young people. And I wanted to hear whether that's in fact true, whether you have had experience getting involved with 350.org, and also whether you know about his divestiture campaign, where he's urging colleges across the country to eliminate their investments in fossil fuel energy sources, and what you think about that.
Unfortunately, he hasn't come to my campus yet. I really wish, hopefully in the future, but I have heard of 350.org, and it's the parts per billion of carbon dioxide are going up, too, so it's getting a little crazy, but hopefully we can get to that optimal point again. Oh, hope is out there. But I think
the divestiture campaign is also something, the idea that colleges not invest their endowment funds in fossil fuel companies.
Yes.
That's something that, yeah, Rosemary?
Oh, yeah. My university also purchases a lot of green power, especially from wind energy, and we also have solar thermal on top of two of our residence halls. But there is a point where we're still trying to go green, and we're still trying to get more connected with a community that doesn't have as much like options yet. And to I guess, to spread green across the world, for it to be as contagious as the flu. Yeah.
We're right here at the end, but last word, Carlene?
Oh, it's just this comment on the divestiture program by Bill McKibben. And it was interesting. I read an article in the New York Times analyzing this. And while this worked with South Africa and apartheid, there's a lot of skepticism that universities won't be able to actually do this because of the big oil money that's necessary for their portfolios, et cetera. But I think, like Mike was saying earlier, I'm like, you know, to, can I say this, hell with the practicalities. We've got a crisis here. We have to do something. We need everybody on deck, and we need to try all options.
Mike Haas, last word.
350 is an example of a group that, again, when we're with young people, it's exactly what we're trying to do. We try to make sure they're aware of all these different groups, you know, that can meet them where they're at. It's so important to meet them where they're at. And that's an example of a group where, again, we help point them to. So it's extraordinarily important, 350 and all kinds of groups that are doing great things.
Our thanks to Mike Haas, founder of the Alliance for Climate Education, Rosemary Davies, a student at Chatham University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Carlene Cullen, founder and executive director of Cool the Earth Campaign. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you all for coming to Climate One today.